I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Goldman Sachs is reporting that its first quarter earnings almost doubled to more than $3 billion. This, of course, as Goldman Sachs is being sued for fraud by the SEC, and as lawmakers in Washington get ready to reveal results of a year-long investigation into the role Goldman Sachs and ratings agencies played in the subprime mortgage meltdown. We're going to see how this is playing out in Washington, but first a primer, and we promise it will be painless. By now, many of you know the basics. Lenders gave out increasingly lousy home loans, which they then sold to Wall Street, which bundled them together and traded them. Some savvy investor figured out that these were ticking time bombs and bought insurance, betting they would fail. In his new book, The Big Short, Michael Lewis writes about investors like Michael Burry doing just this, praying Goldman Sachs and other houses wouldn't catch on to the fact that he was cherry-picking bad home loans and betting they would fail. But now, the SEC is saying that Goldman Sachs actually worked with a hedge fund manager named John Paulson, allowing him to create the financial instruments like Abacus that he then bet against. And then Goldman Sachs didn't reveal this to other investors who bought the same product. And the investigative website ProPublica says many other major investment houses were doing the same thing with hedge funds like one called Magnetar. Jesse Eisinger is senior reporter for ProPublica. And Jesse, start with telling us more about what the SEC is alleging Goldman Sachs did.
The SEC is alleging civil fraud here, that Goldman committed fraud. And what they're saying is that Goldman didn't disclose what the background of one of these complex mortgage products that we've heard so much about. These are the toxic assets that plague Wall Street. Goldman created one of these instruments on behalf of a hedge fund manager, John Paulson, who really had a negative view on the housing market, and he wanted to place bets that would reflect that view. So Goldman constructed this for him and gave him a lot of influence over what went into the mortgage product, which was called a CDO, or collateralized debt obligation.
Well, how would John Paulson influence it? What might he do?
Well, what CDO is a collection of mortgage bonds. And in fact, actually, it gets more complex than this because it's side bets on mortgage bonds.
Right.
A collection of side bets on mortgage bonds. And what Paulson did was select the specific bonds that he wanted to create side bets on. So it's essentially like going through the Major League Baseball roster and picking out all the 200 hitters and putting them in the roster.
Picking out the worst hitters and putting them in the roster and then betting the team won't win.
Exactly, exactly. Like, he's not getting the guys who are hitting all the home runs. He's getting the guys who are striking out.
So is Goldman Sachs in this suit from the SEC, is it being accused of knowing that the mortgage instruments that it was selling were going to blow up, or just knowing that another investor felt that they were going to blow up?
It's accused of not disclosing the influence that Paulson had over the product. So when they went out and they sold this product, what they hadn't told the buyers is that John Paulson had come to them, had helped construct this, had helped choose all those lousy hitters to go into the pool, and was betting against it, that was constructing to bet against it and hoping that it would fail and expecting it to fail. That's what Goldman is alleged to have not done. They didn't disclose any of this. So it's just about basic disclosure. What is material for an investor to know when the investor is making a decision about whether to buy or sell? What does an investor have to know? And the SEC thinks that Goldman failed to disclose some very important facts.
Well, and Jesse, this gets confusing because, again, as we start to read all of this information that we now have, it feels, you know, to someone who's not an economist, that there were many times along the way when Wall Street might have sold instruments that were bound to fail. So what's the legality? I mean, what, you know, Goldman Sachs says sophisticated investors bought investments and they're the ones that are supposed to read the material.
Right. And there's some merit to that argument. If Goldman were simply acting as a broker between one person who has one view, one sophisticated investor has one view, and another sophisticated investor has another view, and is simply making a market, then Goldman doesn't do anything wrong. Goldman doesn't have to disclose on each side, and it's obvious that there's a view one way or another. But this is a different case because there is a specially designed product here, a CDO, made up of derivatives, made up of mortgage bets, and Paulson is picking it and essentially designing it, but it's being represented that it's being managed and designed by another person. So there is this extra layer here where it seems like there is something deceptive, according to the SEC allegations, and it seems to me to be kind of persuasive that I think everybody on a common sense basis would say that it's material. If Goldman Sachs had fully disclosed this investment, okay, here we have an investment. Now, by the way, a hedge fund manager came to us and asked us to create it. And I have to tell you, they put a lot of stuff in that's really lousy. And I also have to tell you, they're shorting it. They're betting against it. Now, I have to tell you all that. Would you still like to buy it? Most sophisticated investors, knowing that information, would not do it. I think we all understand that if it's put that way, that is a material disclosure. And therefore, when Goldman was not doing this, and when the 9 other banks that were doing this for the hedge fund Magnetar, my colleague Jake Bernstein and I just reported on for ProPublica, when they were doing it, that arguably was material as well. Well, but that was never disclosed.
Tell us about Magnetar.
Jake and I found that Magnetar was responsible for an estimated $40 billion worth of deals similar to the Paulson-Goldman-Abacus deal. Paulson may have done about $5 billion worth of these deals. Magnetar did $40 billion of them. Magnetar was the big dog. And Magnetar was doing a bet where it was buying a portion of the deal, a very risky, small slice at the very bottom. And because they committed to buy this portion, the portion that was most vulnerable to losses, they could make a $1 billion deal with as little as $10 million commitment from the hedge fund. And then Magnetar would bet against other parts of the deal.
Well, Jesse, you've said a lot here, so let's just back up, because we've talked about this kind of deal with you before. I think we used an eggplant for the analogy. Today, how about a shish kebab? So we picture a shish kebab with all sorts of veggies on it, and let's say the tomato on the end of the skewer is going to fall off into the grill. So that represents the riskier part of a bundled together investment. So if Magnetar buys the tomato, the riskiest part, it would in turn be paid a higher interest rate for taking that risk. But then Magnetar takes that money and bets that the onion will fall off the skewer.
Yep, exactly. So they get more interest on the bottom portion, but it's the riskiest. And then what they did was they bet against the middle portions of the skewer. There's actually a great video on ProPublica's website that explains this with champagne glasses, because basically what happens is the tower of champagne glasses is set up by the investment bank, and the champagne goes in the top glasses first because they're the safest. They get paid back first. And what's ever left over on the bottom tray, that's the bottom slice for the Magnetars of the world. But Magnetar was taking that interest that it was getting, that high interest in the short term, and using it to bet against, in some cases, the same CDOs that it was creating.
So if they were doing this and doing this much more than Goldman Sachs was, why haven't we heard any suits against Magnetar?
Well, the SEC is looking into a variety of issues about the Magnetar CDOs. There are some lawsuits, but Magnetar is not being sued, and it's far from clear that Magnetar did anything illegal. In fact, Jake and I think they probably didn't do anything illegal from what we've learned. It was perfectly legal to do this. Now, there is a question about whether the investment banks disclosed this properly or whether the managers of the CDOs properly disclosed the investors that Magnetar was involved, because just like in the Goldman Abacus deal, the involvement of Magnetar was never disclosed. And I haven't mentioned the crux, which is that Magnetar often pressured CDO managers and investment banks to choose riskier stuff than they would have otherwise chosen.
Well, Jesse, so we'll wait to see if the SEC fingers other companies that were doing this kind of dealing and then not disclosing that people who are betting against the product were influential in creating the product. But it still seems like it doesn't go to the heart of the whole financial collapse, which was that long before anybody figured out that they should bet against these instruments because they were going to fail, they didn't know they were going to fail. They didn't know that these were lousy investments.
Well, we say, and it's absolutely true, that Magnetar and John Paulson did not create the financial crisis or the housing bubble, that these deals only exacerbated it at the very end. But the causes of the financial crisis and the housing bubble were many and varied and long in the making, much earlier than these kind of crazy derivatives came on the scene. So you're absolutely right. The housing bubble was caused by many factors, you know, the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, policies that encouraged home ownership.
But Jesse, I got to jump in and say, you know, especially having read Michael Lewis's book, these lenders who were furiously selling bad loans to people who didn't even have jobs didn't seem like they were doing it out of some arm twisting. They were doing it because they could turn around and sell those bad loans to Wall Street
who would package them. This was all driven by Wall Street demand, but it was not caused by the kinds of deals that Paulson and Goldman are in trouble for the SEC. That's not what caused the financial
right.
crisis.
Meantime, the people who figured it out that all of these financial instruments were ticking time bombs with these terrible loans buried in them, you know, just tick off. So what was some of the take home for people at Magnetar, for John Paulson? How much money did they make when their bet proved right?
Well, John Paulson famously made billions and billions of dollars personally. I think he made about $4 billion in 2007. A investment magazine estimated that the head of Magnetar made $280 million, which is not billions, but, isn't bad for a year's work. I'd take it. And, there's nothing wrong with people taking negative bets on stocks or bonds or different areas of the market. We need those dissidents. We need those critics. That's a corrective to manias and bubbles. But in this case, what happened was they prolonged the market because they helped create more product because they were trying to short it or bet against it. And that's where things went really wrong.
Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter for the investigative website ProPublica. We'll link you to them on our website, herenow.org. Jesse, thanks as always.
Thanks very much for having me again.
Okay, to Washington next, here and now. Well, Democrats are hoping that hearings in Washington on all of this will help them build popular support for a financial reform bill. Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor joins us with more on that angle. And Gail, first of all, you know, the lawsuit combined with Michael Lewis's popular new book and the ProPublica investigation we just talked about, we know so much more about all of this than we did even months ago. What's the atmosphere there in Washington?
Well, this really is changing everything. I think the big difference between financial regulation and healthcare reform is that most people liked their insurers, or at least they liked their doctors, they liked the care they were getting. Most people do not like big banks, and the idea of blocking reform at this point is a very risky proposition for Republicans. I think that the Friday announcement that as Goldman Sachs is going to be sued for alleged fraudulent behavior only reinforces that notion that banks are too big, financial groups are too big, they're not to be trusted, and if the government doesn't do something, something is wrong.
Well, Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, initially said last week that the bill that Democrats are proposing would be another bank bailout. Now, the Obama administration has since stepped up and said, no, it's exactly the opposite. It will allow investment houses to fail. Yesterday, McConnell stepped back off his statements a bit. He now says both parties are against more bank bailouts. But what does this bill call for that he was objecting to and maybe misunderstanding?
Well, he's looking at a particular fund, a $50 billion fund, that is paid for by the largest banks, and it's designed to help a bank dissolve without charging taxpayers. This is the big hot item for most voters. They do not want any more big bank bailouts on top of big bank bonuses. And the idea of the initial thought was, well, we'll set aside the fund. The big banks that are now solvent will pay for it, anticipating the need down the line to break up a bank that is in fact failing.
Well, Mitch McConnell. I'm sorry to interrupt, but Mitch McConnell characterized it as a bailout, and maybe even though he was wrong in that way, he might have won because the president is now calling for Democrats to strip that fund from the bill.
That is what Geithner told us, Senator Collins, yesterday. Democrats are searching very hard for a Republican vote. That's the other big difference between this and health care reform. We now have a Massachusetts Republican instead of a Massachusetts Democrat. That means Democrats have got to get one Republican. One of the most likely is Susan Collins, and her price, the point she talks about the most often, is getting rid of that $50 billion fund. Geithner told her yesterday that the president doesn't like it either.
Well, and why not? I'm just curious. If it's not taxpayer money, if it's money that banks have to pay into, and if it's money that might help an investment house, you know, again, when they topple, we know how, you know, wired they all are.
That's
to
right.
Each other. They take everyone else. So why be against? Why be against it?
I think it reminds me a lot of the death panel debate. Remember that? It started out with a very good intent. That is, doctors spend a lot of time consulting with families about end-of-life care. Why not pay them for it? Now, there was nothing in that that said grandmother will be terminated, and yet it lent itself to that perception. The perception became bigger than the fact. That's what's happening with this $50 billion fund. It sounds like something big out there. It has something to do with failing big banks. Therefore, it must be another bailout. On the face of it, it is not.
Well, there's another voice being raised, and that of Scott Brown, Massachusetts senator. He said the bill would cost Massachusetts up to 35,000 jobs, making the case it would be more difficult for big insurers to do business. But since then, many of the insurers in this area have said, well, we never gave him that number. Nobody knows where that number came from. He is insisting that there will be jobs lost. What does this tell us about, you know, what direction Republicans might go in on this issue?
Well, Scott Brown came as an independent. He said, I will bring an independent voice to this issue, and he wasn't given a chance to prove that on health care. The House decided to just pass the Senate bill without going through him at all. So this is really his debut on a big bill, and I think it's incumbent upon him, I think his people feel, he feels, to sound as independent as possible. However, if the people you claim to be quoting are disavowing what you're saying, that's a problem.
Well, much of the debate over financial regulations will be in Senator Blanche Lincoln's Agriculture Committee because these derivatives began in very simple forms. They're what farmers bought, you know, futures, betting a price would go up in the future, so you buy it now. Very simple now, of course, very complex. What's at stake for her? Because we just have about a minute, but both Democrats and Republicans are angry at her.
Oh, she is in a miserable race. Numbers very low, and it's just tough. Arkansas is a basically conservative state, and the idea of government doing big things and spending too much money is just a hard tag for her to break out from under. What she's trying to demonstrate here is leadership and independence. The derivatives are one of the toughest things to understand. She's going to face some strong opposition. She's introducing today a much stronger, tougher regulations on derivatives, including a clearinghouse for all of them, much more transparency. Republican Saxby Chambliss, working with Democrat Ken Conrad, is proposing something not as draconian. So even within that world, there's a lot of compromise, a lot of discussion. What will happen will be the banking bill and the agriculture bill will be combined on the floor. So lots of detail to follow here.
Well, I tell you, as you dig deeper, one has to wonder why transparency on derivatives wouldn't be a good thing. That's Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks so much for weighing in with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a break. The latest news is next, and then later, a newly discovered old film, Here and Now. It looked a lot like an iPhone, but the gadget left behind at a bar in California turned out to be the next generation iPhone, not yet on sale, top secret. So is it possible someone accidentally left it, or was this a marketing ploy? The person who found the phone sold it for $5,000 to the tech news website Gizmodo, which then wrote about it, getting Apple's attention. The company sent Gizmodo a letter late yesterday, pretty much saying, give it back. Dave Balter is founder and CEO of Buzz Agent. That's a Boston-based marketing firm. Dave, is there a buzz in the marketing community about whether this was a ploy?
I haven't seen that much interest in that, mainly because Apple typically wouldn't do any sort of stealth type of behavior like that. I think this is an engineer who made a mistake and somebody capitalized on it.
Sure, when Apple does something, it's big and grand and on a stage, and Steve Jobs comes out and people gauge whether or not he's thin, and it's a big deal. It just doesn't seem like something they'd do.
No, I think Apple, you know, has plenty of capability to create its own type of buzz, and this type of behavior just doesn't fit the things they would typically do.
Well, you mentioned stealth. Now, we've spoken on this program about stealth marketing. A mom might be hired to bring her kid in a crisp new baseball uniform to a Little League game so that the other mothers will ask what kind of detergent she uses. That's a form of stealth marketing we were amazed to hear is happening. Well, your company has a different model. What does your company do?
Yeah, we believe that stealth marketing signifies really the truth behind how bad marketing can happen. What we believe is the power of our opinions and the things we actually share with each other, sharing a recommendation, that's what gets people to want to buy. And when they share their opinions with others, we enforce that they have to disclose that they are involved as a volunteer in one of our programs.
This is called word-of-mouth marketing, and your company has some 650,000 agents, hence, Buzz Agent. And they're volunteers. Now, why would they volunteer to go out and talk about a product?
Right. Well, if there's a product we like, something that changes our life, much like an iPhone may, we are going to tell people about it. It's part of how we communicate.
Well, wait a minute. Don't you also give them the product?
We do. So why would they sign up for our services? Because we give them the opportunity, in many cases, to get a product before others. Now, they're not always iPhones. A lot of our products are everyday products, food and beverage. But the reality is we don't pay these people, and what we ask for in return is we'll send you the products. We just want you to do what you do every day and tell us about it so we can help brands understand how it's actually having impact in the marketplace.
Yeah.
Right? And let me be really clear, they don't have to say they like it. We actually don't value if someone says they love something any more than if they tell us they don't love something. We just want to know about it.
This isn't the young woman who might push through a crowd in a bar and order a certain kind of drink because she's paid by a stealth company to order that drink in the hopes that you'll order it too. That's stealth marketing.
Right, right. So to be clear, that's a program called Leaners because they lean into the bar and order a drink. And in this industry, there's really a white hat crowd and a black hat crowd. The black hat crowd are the stealth folks who will try to fool you. The white hat crowd are the people who are going to try to really tap our honest opinions and get people to, hear authentically what you think.
And by the way, there's a new movie out. It's called The Joneses. I'm sure you've heard of it. It takes this stealth marketing, the black hat crowd, one step further. A company actually hires people to act as a family and puts them up in a house, sends them to golf clubs, and gives the kids skateboards so that they'll talk about the products all the time. Here's a clip from the trailer.
They're not just living the American dream. They're selling it.
Do the clients know how this works?
Of course not. That's why it's called self-marketing. If people want you, they'll want what you've got.
Gotta sell, sell, sell.
Have you seen these new MP52 irons?
Just added 40 yards to my drive.
Very nice.
Cool shirt, by the way.
Dave?
Yep.
Is this happening?
I believe this is probably Hollywood making a fantastic example of something that is not real. Marketers aren't spending their days outfitting families in America and trying to fool the whole community into believing that they're something they're not. However, I would challenge any marketer to do this the other way, to actually find a family, provide them everything they want to provide them, and make sure that they're honest and authentic about when they share their opinions, and they will get much more value than if they tried to do it this stealthy way.
Dave Balter, founder and CEO of Buzz Agent, a word-of-mouth marketing firm based in Boston. We'll have their website at ours, hereandnow.org. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, a Princeton scholar on SATs, why Asian Americans, for example, need better scores than Caucasians. That's tomorrow. Back in a bit, Here and Now. A slice of film history will be on display today at Keene State College in New Hampshire. A 97-year-old 30-minute silent film was found in an old New Hampshire barn that was about to be demolished. The film's been restored and is being screened at the college today. The 30-minute film is called When Lincoln Paid. It features actor Francis Ford, the older brother and mentor of film icon John Ford. He directed The Searchers, or She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and Fort Apache.
Colonel, if you send out the regiment, Cochise will think I've tricked him.
Exactly. We have tricked him. Tricked him into returning to American soil, and I intend to see that he stays here.
Colonel. Some of the glorious work of John Ford. Well, Tag Gallagher is a film historian. He's seen the newly unearthed silent film that features Ford's brother, Francis Ford. It's called, again, When Lincoln Paid. And by the way, you can see a few clips at our website, hereandnow.org. But Tag, first of all, as a film buff, what does this find mean to you?
Well, what excites me about it is Francis Ford. Francis Ford appears in about 31 of John Ford's movies. And if you're into John Ford, you get to know Francis Ford very quickly. He has these roles that are mostly pantomime, often a coonskin drunk. He can spit across a room and make a spittoon ring. People may remember him particularly in The Quiet Man. He's an old man with a long white beard, and he's in his deathbed dying, and when he hears that the fight's going on between John Wayne and Victor McLaughlin, he jumps out of his bed and goes running across the countryside to see it. So people knew about Francis Ford because of these great little cameo appearances that he had in all these films, and he was in lots of other movies too.
I'm remembering, just to throw out a couple as people might be remembering, he was the drunken juror in Young Mr. Lincoln with Henry Fonda.
There is a great moment in Young Mr. Lincoln when the prosecutor is denouncing alcohol and Francis Ford comes out with a loud burp. But that's the sort of thing he did. And in Judge Priest, he's a juror, and he spits across the room whenever the prosecutor is talking. And
yeah.
The spit tune, and he makes it ring.
And how did he affect his brother?
Back before World War I, Francis Ford was a really big star. He was partnered with a woman named Grace Cunard, and together they made some of the most successful serials, mystery serials. Lucille Love, The Broken Coin. And before that, he was a Western and Civil War type star. And he, around 1912, 1913, he was responsible for some of the very first super spectacular films that came out of Hollywood with huge casts. And this film, When Lincoln Paid, is one of that series.
Well, tell us more about that. It came out in 1913. There was a review from Moving Picture World, that's a weekly that was sent to film distributors, and called it a great war drama with vivid battle scenes. Tell us more about this film.
This whole series of films that were being made by, actually called the New York Motion Picture Company, but it was located in California, and they had hired a whole rodeo show, a whole circus, and so they had hundreds and hundreds of extras and Indians and horses and wagons, and spectacular scenery, and they made these series of films, which were at that time 30 minutes long. This was when the standard film was 15 minutes. So these were bigger, more gigantic films. This, When Lincoln Paid, was one of those films that has battle scenes in it and stuff like that.
What's the plot?
The plot is basically when Lincoln, as a young lawyer, is helped by a woman, and later, when he's president, she comes begging for the life of somebody. And at first he has to refuse, but then she shows him a note he left her promising to pay this debt. And so he pays the debt and pardons the young man.
Is it true?
I don't know. He pardoned people. The subplot is this woman's son had been killed by the Confederates for supposedly being a spy. And he had begged for his life and they had refused. And then the same Confederate officer's son was captured by the Union. And now it's his life she's pleading for.
Huh.
So there's a melodrama within the melodrama.
Right. And Francis Ford plays Lincoln. Does he look like him, or our sense of what, you know, Lincoln looked like?
Well, I mean, more or less with a beard. He played him in 8 films. All of these were lost. But the 8 films were all made in the same period of 1912, 1914, this 2-year period. And, of course, the Civil War at that time was a living memory. There are many people alive who were in their 50s or 60s who had fought in it. And Lincoln, like sort of Elvis Presley today, there were Lincoln impersonators who went all over the country giving speeches and shows and imitations of him. And so Francis Ford was a notable one of these people, and therefore it's a slice of Americana. And Francis Ford was 13 years older than John. He was born Frank Thomas Feeney in Portland, Maine, and John Ford was born John Martin Feeney. And Francis had been a troublesome child and had run away from home, and the family had completely lost track of him for years. And then one day they saw him at the local movie theater on the screen, and they were able to trace him, and he came back home to Portland. And then John Ford went out to Hollywood, and for 3 years was Francis Ford's assistant and learned everything. He probably had the most complete preparation for making films of any major Hollywood director. He owed everything to Francis.
Huh. Some people are going to get a chance to see this film today at Keene College. What was it like for you to see it?
I had read a great deal and seen still photos of as Francis Ford playing Lincoln, and so it was nice to see these things.
Is it in good shape?
No. Unfortunately, it's in rather poor shape, and they restored it the best they could, and you can follow the story. And I think it might eventually appear on DVD and in some of these boxes that they've been doing of treasures from American archives.
It's really amazing to go online and see at the Keene College website the people commenting. They seem so thrilled. You know, this is wonderful, wonderful news that this film has been found. Like you, they have this sense of Francis Ford, I think more so than most people would. So is this sort of a victory for Francis Ford fans that the brother of John Ford, you know, might get a little bit more of his due?
Yeah. You know, I think that 95% of the population out there thinks that seeing a 10-year-old film is like reading a 10-year-old newspaper. But the other 5%, you know, love these movies and watch them religiously. And so among those people, you know, Francis Ford is a real personality. And it's so curious because his character in the John Ford films is the exact opposite of what he was when he was a star. He was a star. He dressed. He could wear clothes fantastically. He was very handsome and debonair, and he wore tuxedos and white tie, except in the Westerns when he wore, you know, I mean, like a Western pioneer. But he was a tall, romantic hero.
That's Tad Gallagher, a film historian, talking about a long-lost 97-year-old silent film about Abraham Lincoln, played by Francis Ford, brother of film icon, the director John Ford. The film is screening at Keene State College in Keene, New Hampshire, but you can also see a couple of clips at our website, hereandnow.org. Tag, thanks so much for the look into history that's very much in the present right now. Thank you.
Sure.
At the beginning of Eric Puchner's debut novel, Model Home, Warren Ziller is finally living the dream. He'd always wanted to leave Wisconsin, where his father was sickly, his mom pumped gas and smelled of it. When his friend Larry called with a golden opportunity to pour all their money into building a housing development in California, Warren jumps and lands in L.A. stunned to see baggage handlers wearing shorts. Then, with his wife and kids, he joins the culture.
It was his single accomplishment, providing for these beautiful snot-faced creatures that Camille had brought into the world. He'd moved them to California and bought a larger house than they needed, seduced by the idea of giving them even more. How proud he'd been showing them the big lawn and persimmon tree, the famously expensive views of L.A. He'd filled the extra space with overpriced furniture, leasing it until he had the money to buy it outright. He wasn't worried. In a year or two, they'd be as rich as his neighbors. Now it was all disappearing. This room, this house, this life he'd built from scratch.
Eric Puchner reading from his new novel, Model Home, about Warren Zeller's real estate venture, which ends a spectacular failure. And Eric joins us from the NPR studios in Culver City. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
When did you write this? Because it could have been now, as well as when you have it set in the mid-'80s.
Yeah, I wish that I could say I was brilliantly prophetic, but I started the book a few years before the whole subprime loan disaster. But it did seem to prefigure our current economic crisis in a surprising way.
Well, the current crisis is sort of your story writ large. In the mid-'80s, you know, everyone thought building houses in the desert in California was a no-brainer. And so does Warren Ziller. But tell us more about who he is.
Well, Warren Ziller is somebody who is very much a Wisconsinite. He's a Midwesterner. And he has given up his dreams of being a lawyer to provide for his family in the most immediate way possible, which for him meant becoming a real estate developer. And he gets lured out to California by one of his business partners who holds up this sort of golden carrot of developing these houses out in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And he gets seduced by this sort of what he perceives as being a sort of glamorous lifestyle. And he's also seduced by the landscape itself. He sort of falls in love with the eerie beauty of the desert and the Joshua trees and the idea, that sort of pioneer spirit of moving out west.
And seduced maybe also by the idea of being a better father than his was, and sort of winning over his kids by presenting them with this surfer lifestyle. Not all his kids want it.
No, Lyle in particular. Lyle, which is short for Delilah, who's at the beginning of the book, is a 16-year-old girl. Is sort of in many ways the antithesis of California and the Californian lifestyle. You know, she's very pale. She gets sunburned all the time when she goes to the beach. She becomes this sort of misanthropic Californian. Whereas Dustin sort of represents the other side of the Californian dream. He loves California. He loves the beach. He's a surfer. He's popular. He's in an aspiring punk band. And I actually created both Lyle and Dustin to represent my ambivalence about Southern California. I was a teenager in Southern California as well, in suburban LA, and I both sort of hated it and loved it. And so I sort of split myself in two like an amoeba and put the part, all the things I loved about California into Dustin's character, and all the things that I sort of hated about it into Lyle's character.
And by the way, where are you from?
My dad was a businessman who had a very difficult time working for anybody. We ended up moving all over the country. But I grew up on the East Coast until I was 12 and then moved out to Southern California.
Uh-huh. Because, you know, a couple of things are revealed there. I mean, you were also a transplant, but also had a dad who had difficulties, you said, working for anyone. And there's this whiff of Death of a Salesman here. Is that something that you wanted to convey?
It wasn't a conscious echo. There's certainly that sense of failure that's similar, and that sort of the idea of the American dream falling on its face.
But I also want to highlight the kids, because they're so prominent in the book. There's a third child, Jonas. As the youngest might sometimes be, he's sort of lost, obsessed with the story of a local girl who's disappeared. You find kids like these kids all over America, you know, one who's embracing the popular culture, one who's rejecting it, one who's sort of lost. But there's something about California, for people who've been there, if you live there, you know, there's something about when the sun shines so brightly on disaffected kids. It's sort of, there's more of a contrast or something.
I think you're right about the fact that because of the climate and because of our sort of preconceptions about what California represents, it's a little bit startling to see these horribly lost children. But I did want to capture this idea, that something that I feel like is a phenomenon in America, which is you can have incredibly loving parents, in fact, who upturn their entire lives for you, and that may not necessarily be what you need as a kid and as a teenager.
Sure. In this case, everything might have been just fine if they'd stayed in their house in Wisconsin. I mean, Warren did this in part to get his kids this sunny lifestyle, and it becomes epically tragic. I mean, when you think, oh my gosh, it can't get any worse, it does. What's the takeaway? I mean, where might redemption have been? What's the cautionary tale?
Well, if only they stayed in Wisconsin, as you suggested. Well, I think in many ways I was interested in revealing the failure of the American dream, in a way that the American dream is in some ways a false desire or a false promise. And we certainly see that today with the housing market. This idea of people moving out to the exurbs, and the fact that people live in these bedroom communities in the middle of the desert and sometimes commute 2 hours each way to get to work. And what's that done to our sense of community? But also, what is attractive about that? Why do people want to own a home so badly? And how is that wrapped up in providing for your family and giving them what you think they deserve? I didn't want it to be an easy cautionary tale. I wanted it to be sort of, this is in some ways an untenable dream to have. And here are some of the possible consequences of that untenable dream.
And, you know, in reading it, you didn't intend this. As you said, you started it long ago, but it's stomach-turning to think how many families are going through this idea of, you know, dad not able to tell everyone, guess what, we don't have any money and the house is underwater. And, you know, that emptiness that you show happens in the house when the furniture first goes. And, you know, that's happening thousandfold.
There is in the second half of the book, they end up moving out to this single block of homes that have been built as Warren's subdivision in the middle of the desert, and it's almost this sort of post-apocalyptic environment where they're living out there with, you know, all these desert creatures, and there's a toxic waste dump nearby. And, you know, as several people have said, it's become very emblematic, I think, of what's happened with the housing market.
That's Eric Buchner. His book is Model Home. He's been speaking to us from the NPR studios in Culver City. By the way, we don't want to give anything away, but there, suddenly we find ourselves in a burn unit with severely burned people. It's a one, you know, a shard of the story. Why fire and burning? Is that sort of it feels like hell.
There's something that happened to a friend of mine, something that he witnessed that has stuck in my head for years and so sort of captures the precariousness of home that I couldn't get it out of my head.
Can I jump in and say, was it a home fire and someone trying to put someone else out?
It was, in fact, someone who came home from vacation and lit a cigarette and their house exploded. And my friend's wife was the one who ran out and put the flames out.
Well, it's very, very powerful. Again, that's Eric Buchner. His new novel is Model Home. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.